He goes, I know I say I'm always excited about guests on the show, but this is one that we've been chasing for a very long time, because essentially every single person we've spoken to has said, yep, get him, get this guy on. He's played for Australia in all three forms. He's captained the country in white ball cricket, where he served with distinction. He's a Tasmanian stalwart and, dare I say, legend. And, you know, frankly, quite obviously one of the best blokes in cricket. I'm, of course, talking about George Bailey. George, welcome to the show.
With a rap like that, why wasn't I first off the bloody rank?
Well, we had to get Ed Cowan on the show four times before we got you, so that's the package deal.
Yeah. We always start the same way, George, and I do it with trepidation, particularly when we talk to international quality players. But, you know, what is your relationship to grade cricket? What does it mean to you?
Well, it's where the game's still played. So you get back to grade cricket and it's actually played for the reason that you started playing cricket, and it gets to the point I've certainly found over the last 10 years or so, when your relationship with cricket isn't that strong, you're not feeling much love for it, and inevitably you get back and play a couple of games of grade cricket, and you rediscover your love for it. You realise that you're playing with blokes who are playing for the right reasons, and blokes who prove that you can still play with a reasonable hangover, which I think always gives you a great deal of perspective.
So when you say that, George, that blokes are playing for the right reason, I assume that when you come back to training, these blokes are asking you for, you know, got any gloves, got any kit, got a spare stick. And to that end, do you have any spare gloves I can have?
Just how friendly. You can always tell, I reckon, who's desperate for gloves with who's actually gone and done a bit of research on your last few games. I mean, the bloke who comes up and says, geez, I thought that LB was stiff a couple of weeks ago. You're just right. I know you need something. I'll keep that in mind. Seafood's a big one down here. I'll get a few blokes who, this time of year in particular, suddenly start saying, oh, Bales, you like crayfish, don't you? You're abalone. I'm actually going out this weekend if you want anything. Right, gotcha. That sounds like a bat, that sort of thing.
So you're saying that in Tasmania there's a different economy to, say, money. You actually just trade in seafood and cricket kit.
Yeah, seafood, salmon, apples have gone down the window the last few years. I think livestock's still not bad, but Craig, if you're talking, and grey nickels too, we're talking premium product here. It's crayfish, big buggers.
Can you give us paint us a bit of a picture, Bales, and I'll call you Bales, we've just met over the phone literally just now, but can you paint a bit of a picture about what kit you would wear to grade cricket training? Like, I was lucky enough to play with a couple of guys who played for Tassie when they were in Sydney. So, like, Brendan Drew and Jason Crazier both had vastly different approaches to the kit they would wear to training. Drew, he was always about wearing the Tigers kit, the Balmain Tigers kit, and Crazier was wearing his academy kit at all times. What does George Bailey wear to training?
I try and get some form of South Hobart Sandy Bay gear on. Generally, it's a few years older than the updated, than whatever the young kids are running around in this particular day. And depending how long I've been there, look, you may just have to throw something Australian or Hurricanes on, just in case there's a few younger blokes down there who haven't actually spotted you at training, and you just... It's much easier, I think, to set the tone with a bit of that gear than having to go around and actually tell everyone what you've done, isn't it?
Just to continue the sort of silly theme of kit, George, if I can, just for a moment. And that, you know, sometimes when I roll around the house in a hot summer's day, I just wear like old club shorts or like an old training singlet. Like, do you ever like just rock the, you know, an old Australian T20, you know, vest around the house, for instance?
Absolutely. Most Saturday nights, I'm still in my orange vest that I grew particularly fond of during the World Cup.
Yeah.
Can often be found gardening in the yellow floppy.
Yeah, very good.
But I do. But if I need to go down to Bunnings or something, I'm not. I get that off. Green. That's right. Yeah. Did you get your discount here, or? But I tell you what, I have. I reckon you boys would like this. I'll tell you what I've brought back to Sandy Bay over the last couple of seasons is a beautiful little Terry Towling hat that I've actually been wearing in game. The Sandy Bay baggy was a little uncomfortable. I don't know if it was a sizing issue or they just perhaps the standard, and it just wasn't working. I'd lost my cap somewhere in another bag, so it was forced to don a Terry Towling one day, and it fit. It just felt right. So I'm now seeking a little Sandy Bay badge that I can sew onto the front, or at least three quarters sew on the front, so it looks like it's been on there a little while. And I reckon we could sell a few of those, because that's a little vote catcher too, I reckon, with the umpires.
George, I could ask this question really earnestly, but I won't. Like, there's a lot of – we talk a lot on the show and through all of our indulgent mediums, Twitter and book and books and whatever. I don't even know how this is still going, because it's all really just recycled. But, like, we're often talking about what it takes to get to the top of the sort of social capital ladder of grade cricket or cricket in general. And your name keeps coming up when people talk about someone who really is just popular in cricket. I'm not going to ask you how do you be popular in cricket, but really, can you tell us how to be popular in cricket, and also give advice to anyone listening out there about how they can be popular in cricket?
Well, short currency, and I don't think this works long term, is runs and wickets. But you'd be a fool if you thought that was a long term solution. Well, grade level, and as I've got older, this certainly rings true. But I always reckon the youngster who does pretty well on the circuit always sort of live vicariously through them a little bit. So I tend to gravitate. If there's a youngster who brings with him a bit of a reputation for heading out most Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, and the odd uni night during the week, I gravitate to him. He's normally got plenty of stories to share, which makes me feel young again. And then I think it might just be someone who's got what happens to be a trendy job at the time. That can be that can give you a little bit of status as well.
I like the acknowledgement.
Which I've got at Sandy Bay, so it's really just I am seeking the others out.
I appreciate that you have acknowledged that there are things beyond just runs and wickets as well that contribute to being popular in cricket. Can we just talk a bit about your cricket?
They certainly work. They work, don't they? I mean, the young fella who takes a five for a score of 100, particularly post-Christmas when you're starting to get to the dangly part of the season, the middle part of the season. But let's be honest. I mean, if you're living week to week with that sort of pressure hanging over your head, I'm not sure it's sustainable.
I honestly don't know what you're talking about with January being the dangly part of the season. I never played finals cricket or got any medals, but nevertheless, I think you're quite good at the game. George, let's talk about your cricket a little bit, if we could just do that quickly, because we probably should. You're with the Hurricanes at the moment and Tassie. I mean, how is your cricket going? You're talking a little bit here about getting older and realising you just want to do what you feel. You've got your Terry Towling hat on. You know who you want to associate with on the circuit. How's your own cricket going?
Yeah, I'm faced with one of probably the biggest cricketing conundrums I've ever faced in my career at the moment, because I've stumbled upon a bit of a technique, which is awful. I mean, I'm the first to put my hand up and say it's particularly putrid. And it's working, and I'm at the stage now where I'm sort of thinking, when my professional cricketing career is done, I actually don't think I can ever set foot on the field again, because I just can't. You just can't be playing muck around games, batting the way I'm batting. So I'm really stuck between basically giving away the professional career, going back to a standard technique, and averaging 22 for the last 12 months of my career, or keep sticking my bum at the bowler, keep averaging 50 as I've done for 18 months, and then never ever play again. So I don't know if you've got any thoughts there to help me out, but I'm at a bit of a loss. And this is purely red ball, white ball cricket. I mean, Big Bash, I can't even hit a two at the moment, let alone these blokes who are just popping balls onto the top of stadiums. And just, they look like it's just whatever ball they decide to hit for a six, these youngsters. Mm. It just goes. Whereas, I've got no answers to that. So I feel like T20's gone past me, and four-day cricket, I've got about like... Oh, I don't know how to describe it, but in a pretty ordinary way to just make it work.
I like the self awareness of that, George. Like, you asked for our thoughts. Like, I've got a particularly highbrow one. There's a great podcast by Malcolm Gladwell called Revisionist History, and he talks about this issue that Wilt Chamberlain, the great NBA basketballer from 40, 50 years ago, had, where he. I think he scored 100 points in a game once. He realized that his when he went to the foul line, to the free throw, that he was far more accurate with what they called the granny shot, basically underarming the basketball into the net as opposed to the overhead shot. But he decided that he didn't want to do the granny shot, even though it was far more accurate and effective for him, because it just looked weird. He was more interested in just, chopping birds and looking good, really, and he was happy with 100 points. So, if you do better with the weird technique, is that really much better? You know, what is cricket about? It's a great existential question.
Mm. That's the spectrum. Where you at? And Wilt was obviously nailing it on a number of fronts there. If you're missing half a dozen free throws but still scoring 100 points, then no stress. I certainly feel that granny shot. That's a simplification of the game, isn't it? That works. Yeah. Whereas I feel like I don't know what a cricketing example would be, but I feel like I've almost. My reasons behind it, which I certainly can't be bothered going into, simplify for me.
Yeah.
But it's not simple, is it? I mean, it's not. Now the worst thing is I get these pictures from my mates and coaches around Tassie of these poor little 8 and 9 year old boys who are trying to face up a training with their legs the wrong way around, their backside of the bowl. And I just think, don't worry about the cricket. Like, you're going to get ridiculed. This will cost you. The social cost of what you're doing. How do you explain that to an 8-year-old?
George, I mean, the whole point of cricket, as we all know, is looking good, and that is literally the opposite of looking good. Like, I presume most listeners would know what you're talking about, but it's essentially like your back, most of your back is facing the bowler, and you're sort of looking over your left-hand shoulder. I mean, you don't need to come about, I don't want you to answer this question by telling me, the ins and outs of why that technique is working, but I mean, can you just give us a reason as to how that even started? Like, how that was even a thought process that came into your mind, that basically facing the wrong way was going to work for you?
I think it was just when you're on a bit of a good thing. I think I started side on, or just a little bit closed off in the hope, because it was keeping me more side on. And I was getting into a really stable position, hitting the ball harder. So they're good things. And then that worked for a little bit. And then I got out a couple of times. And then I thought, maybe I'm not side on enough. So I just went a little bit further. And then that worked again for a little bit. And then, the evolution of it, I think, means that in about, if I played for another 3 years, I'll just be left-handed.
Well, as we know, batting left-handed is cheating, and Brabham would have averaged 472 if he was left-handed. So, George, you are playing for the Hurricanes at the moment, and you guys are third in the ladder. You guys have played your allotted games. There's a couple of games left for the Melbourne Renegades, especially, I think, one more game for the Sixers. So you guys do hold the final spot at the moment. I mean, what sort of chances are you giving yourself to play in the finals of the Big Bash this year?
Well, we've got one more. We've got the Stars on Saturday. So I think if we win that, I think we're a lock. Think we're in. And then if we don't, I think that then it becomes all about the mathematical equations. But I've tried to spruik it to our team that I feel like if we win, I feel like we have been one of the better teams throughout the competition. Having said that, I think if we lose this game and we end up 5-5, then I don't think we've got any complaints if we happen to miss out. So destiny in our own hands, which is a bit of a funny one in T20, because you talk, I think if you get a bit of a feel over a season about teams that are good or not so good. But T20, I always reckon, even if you're the best team, you only ever get to about a 60%, you know, chance of being definite winners. It's never such a black and white sort of thing with favouritism. And I get that feeling when you look at the stars. Maxi's hit form, and beware the wounded animal a little bit. They haven't really had much of a run. And Kevin Peters' last game, you're just a bit worried about what they might bring to the table. So we'll have to be at our best, and if we are, then I think we can do a bit of damage in the finals, actually.
Like, can you talk about Jofra Archer just for a moment? Just because he's blown some batsmen away this tournament with his pace as much as anything else. You know, a lot of people know that he's a West Indian guy and he's trying to qualify to play for England down the track. I mean, you must be facing him in the nets. I mean, what's he like in the nets? Because some of the skills he's displaying at that sort of pace is actually quite frightening for like a, you know, an Australian point of view down the line if he does qualify eventually to play for England.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first up, I don't bat in the nets at all anymore because it's just, I face a bit of spin, but they're too fast. Everyone's too fast. So that's I certainly don't do that. But he looks, I mean, he's put a lot of our boys on their backsides. And just chatting to everyone who's faced him, I've faced him a little bit in England, but he's that ambled, relaxed run up. It's just so hard to trick or get ready for then what eventually comes out of the hand, and just the velocity and the bounce. I think that's Australia almost suits him better than England in many respects, and he's got a pretty good record in England too. But I think the bounce that he generates here, along with his speed, has been phenomenal. I certainly didn't know that he was as skilled at nailing his Yorker as he has been. And just, I mean, in typical West Indies fashion, just a very relaxed guy. Just, you know, you spend all that time planning and setting fields and, right, this is what we're going to do, this fella and this fella. And then you get to the top of the mark, nine runs to win or something in the last over. You can hardly hear each other speak over the crowd. I can't understand Joff, he can't understand me. And then he grabs you by the shoulder and says, "Skipper, set whatever field you want, mate." that confidence that you're just going to nail your Yorker and nail your bouncer and wander off the ground as a winner.
That's a great insight, George. Just before we get to the throwdown section where it will degenerate into stupidity, I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about what Tasmania means to you from a cricketing standpoint, mate. I mean, you know, for two guys from Sydney, we always look at Tassie and think, you know, what a... Like, everyone who goes to Tassie to play seems to only have good things to say about their time there. You know, there's obviously been some legends who've played down there. You're obviously one of them and will go down as one. I mean, what is it about Tassie that's so enjoyable for cricketers?
Well, first and foremost, there's not a great deal else to do. So, you know, I feel like... I mean, the option of an extra training session comes up. It's not like, well, geez, the weather's so good. Oh, I was going to go to the beach. No. We're going to go and see what's-her-name play, you know, a concert or... No, that's not... So, I'm just going to have an extra training session. I'll pick you up. How far? Oh, 10 minutes. Yeah, 10 minutes, I can do that. So, I mean, that proximity and ease of getting everyone together, I think, plays a part, certainly for the guys who have moved from interstate. I hope that they would feel like it's easy for them to catch up with people, to build a sort of circle of friends, whereas perhaps, and I've never lived in Melbourne or Sydney, but if you move there... come the end of training, everyone sort of heads in their own directions and heads home. Well, the proximity that we have to each other and probably more importantly for your girlfriends and wives and things to be able to have a circle of friends, that keeps everyone pretty happy. I mean, it's an interesting one. We had building up in my first years and then up until a number of, 3 or 4 years ago, we had a great deal of success and then it fell away a lot quicker than we certainly would have hoped. I felt like we'd built up some pretty good cultural and cricket-specific
currency, and we, I feel like we lost that pretty quickly. So certainly, I mean, I don't have too long left in the game, but I'd like to get Tassie back to the stage where we're competitive day in, day out, because they were certainly very enjoyable years.
George, we'll move on to, after a little bit of earnest cricket chat, we'll move on to the throwdown section. Basically, we ask you stupid questions. The humour's wrapped up in the question. If you find it funny, good. Give us your answer by all means, or pass on it if it's ridiculous. So can I start?
Please, yeah.
Okay. George, you've got, according to Wikipedia anyway, which is often wrong, you've got tertiary qualifications in business. You're currently studying an MBA. This is relevant anyway. You captained the ODI side in 2012 and offered comment about Channel 9's negativity toward the ODI side at that time, saying it was largely about TV rights. You know, that's why they were talking it down. And Channel 9, as you know, Channel 9's executive director of cricket, Brad McNamara, said this was rubbish, that George should stick to playing cricket and leave the television rights to people who know what they're talking about, that you needed to understand where your money's coming from, and without the TV rights deal, you were probably working in a coal mine or flipping burgers at McDonald's. So I guess my question is, I take it you're more of an ABC grandstand man these days.
Well, the thing that cut to the bone with that statement was I'd been playing professional cricket for about 10 years at that stage. I just reckon I would have progressed to at least being on the drive-through. I don't reckon I could have been flipping burgers. And some people might say, "Oh, you're a bit full of yourself." It's a little bit more difficult than that. But I don't know. I feel like I would have gone somewhere.
George, on the 25th of August 2014, the Grey Cricketer tweeted, and I quote, "George Bailey seems like the kind of bloke who'd not only help you move, but show up early with extra boxes he had lying around the house." That tweet copped 147 retweets and 612 likes. Can you help me move this weekend?
It's the worst job in the world, isn't it, moving here? If there's a sausage and a beer at the end of it, mate, no worries.
More Twitter stuff here, George. I don't know if you caught this. You're telling us off air that you're considering getting on Twitter, but you're not yet. So I just wanted to run this by you. I'm sure it made its way to you. Someone you might have heard of called Shane Warne wrote last week, and I quote, "Why would George Bailey stand in such a ridiculous way and complicate batting? I'm all for individuals doing their thing, but this is horrific to watch. M. Waugh was one of the best ever cricketers to watch do any facet of the game, bat, bowl or field. Keep it simple." So, George, my question to you is, why can't you just be more like M. Waugh?
Well, that's true. That's true. I'd like to be. I sort of feel like we could be just in parallel universe. So Junior was lovely to watch on the cricket field, but putrid to listen to when he's commentated. So I'm hoping on the cricket field might proceed being reasonable in a commentary box at some stage of my life.
That sounds like a come get me with, probably not Channel 9, but anyway, I'll carry on. George, obviously you won the Ashes in 2013, famously, I'm sure you remember that. And at the Gabba, it was reported that James Anderson, in the lead up to the whole get ready for a broken arm thing, that Jimmy Anderson threatened to punch you. So I just want to know which one of your sixes in the 28 runs off his over in Perth, which was your favourite?
The first one, I think, because it doubled my aggregate of runs in the series for that stage.
Very good. Sometimes
I had a very funny conversation with Kevin Peterson in that test. He looked at me and said, "You're grinning. You're always grinning. Why are you grinning? And I said, I'm just having a really good time, Kevin. You know, we've won the first couple of tests. This is the third one. I think we're going to win this one, and things are going pretty well." And he said, "Yes, but you are not going very well. And I do not think," he said, "George, I do not think that you will play many tests." And I said, "I tend to agree with you, mate, but I'm going to enjoy every one that I do because I don't think this is going to last long."
That's great. Sometimes, George, we go to other players, so people that we've contacted over time and asked them for some background on future guests. And I've been asked to query with you a habit you have of calling everybody by the wrong name in what has been described as an ultimate alpha move. So a particular example of poor Gary Putland, who's often called Langy by you. Can you just run us through this? Is this a deliberate tactic to alpha people, or are you spacey?
No, and he's just one of a long list of first class cricketers I'm so worried about what people think of me too. And Ed, I'm sure Ed's told that. Ed Cowan thinks it's the funniest thing he's ever seen, and I just then stress about it for about a week later. I've always been one of those. I hate not knowing someone's name, or when you know that you're supposed to, and should I just go with a mate, and then you get that confidence. No, I'm going to have a crack here. I'm going to go with his name. And Samsonite, you're way off.
All right, Bales, it's here goes you, mate. Just want to ask you. There's actually some viral footage that goes out on the old YouTubes of you after the Ashes winning series in Perth, the aforementioned series, and it's you in the dressing room. Mark Taylor's in there, I think, interviewing some players, and you're just like popping bottles open for the boys, just like cracking beers. And I just want to know how many times you've actually watched that footage, because I've seen it about 25 times.
I don't think I have. What am I doing?
You're basically opening beers with other beers. So like you're using like one beer to open up another beer. No opener. I'm not sure what the beer of choice was doing, but you were just passing them around for the lads. It was just like absolutely alpha.
Mm.
That is the one thing I learned from my, you got to broaden your horizons. My year playing cricket in Holland. Because you buy your 24 beers in the in a plastic sort of carry tray at the supermarket there, and if you return your 24 bottles, you basically get about half your cash back. So for some reason, I don't know why it is, but it's a very Dutch thing that you use one of the beers to open the other 23. That's how it goes. So it's been a handy part of the trick that day. If we get round to this moving house thing, I'll do a couple of those.
What a dreamboat, alpha and cultured and a recycler. George, this is the last one from me. This request to ask this question did not come from Ed Cowan, I should say. It was from someone else. But it was simply just to ask you about an incident with the World Cup trophy in the celebrations. That was it. Just ask him about the World Cup trophy.
Yeah, it was very early. And I'd been sitting on the trophy for most of the evening, and it felt sturdy. It's a good trophy, and someone just remarked that I'm not sure sitting on it was a particularly good idea in case it broke. And I was standing at the time, and I just said, "Nah, look, it's as strong as anything." And a donkey kicked it, and it just snapped in two. And we had the civic reception at Fed Square about 4 hours later, maybe. I reckon it was about 6:30, and I think that we had to be at Fed Square with the World Cup at 11. So never save it up so quickly, frantically going through the yellow pages looking for a welder to get this thing back together. So I'm heading around Melbourne trying to get this thing fixed, and it gets fixed, but it's not in A1 condition. So I get back to the hotel, quickly get changed, take the World Cup into the team room, and say, "Lads, it's back in one piece. But look, the rule is today we've got to, if you're going to pick it up using both handles, preferably two people holding it at all times if we can." Everyone says, "Yeah, no worries." I didn't know Pup wasn't in the room. He walked in 5 minutes later, picked it up one-handed, and the whole thing just fell apart again. To which I'm thinking, "Oh, this is a disaster." And our media manager says, "That's okay, we'll just use the replica." So I slept 4 hours, which was valuable sleeping time. That could have been... I needed that sleep. trying to, and I've actually still got one of the screws. I've got one of the World Cup screws, and so my two World Cup mementos are the orange 12th man vest and one of the screws out of the trophy when I broke. Good.
All right, George. We'll sign off with this one. But obviously, your one day career, which we haven't touched on, unfortunately, which is decorated and seriously impressive over the years, averaging 40, I think, in ODI cricket. But famously, you hit 156 in India, in Nagpur, I think it was, and the side managed to go on and actually lose the game. Therefore, you completed the greatest feeling in cricket, scoring 100 in the losing side. And you were also captain of that game. And I just want to know how smug you were to the boys when you gave the captain's talk after the match. And what did you say?
So I love this because we've all been there, and I think this is very pertinent for grade cricket, isn't it?
Yes.
If you can't be smug, then when can you be? So I sat them down, and I think it was probably the turning point for someone like Shane Watson. I really feel like I turned his career around that night, because I just basically said to the lads, why can't you all just bat a bit more like me?
That's all we wanted.
Little did they know that I was going to change my technique and start facing the bowler with my ass. But luckily, I've stopped batting like me. No, that was an extraordinary series, wasn't it? Runs galore. Yeah. There should be some sort of everything should have been divided by about seven, I reckon, that series.
Yeah.
George, we have overstayed our initially stated welcome with you in this chat. I hope you see it as a factor of how much we've enjoyed it. We hope you have too. And you've definitely lived up to our anticipation for having you on. We apologise that we didn't have you on first. Ed Cowan is very sensitive about remaining the number one guest on the Grade Cricketer. Hello, Ed, if you're listening. And so he will remain that. Don't worry, Ed. But we've really enjoyed having you on, mate, and I hope you have too.
I absolutely have. I'm actually going to download a few episodes now, I think, and have a listen to you lads.
Good man. Good luck for the season, mate. We'll catch you soon.
Beautiful. Thanks very much.
We Grade Cricketers work hard. Everything has to be hard at all times. Work hard. Circuit hard. Just be hard. Never smart. Always hard.
The voices you've heard before were, of course, Vish, our wonderful journalist Vish from the UK, Mitchell Marsh, and George Bailey, who are all now friends of the show. And, of course, famously, another friend of the show, Dave Edwards, has stepped away from the mic. That's why he was not present for George's interview, because we're recording this on two separate days. Such is the requirements of this podcast and our commitment to it and to you, the listener. But it is that time of the week, just for one final time of this Australian summer before we take a little hiatus, and it's Ask TGC. I always say it's our favourite time of the week, and, you know, when we answer the questions, Pez, I do enjoy this time of the week. But, you know, cycling through some of, like, the literal dozens and dozens and possibly even hundreds upon some weeks of rubbish questions that are borderline offensive. That's my least favourite time. But when we get to the good ones, or the ones that I pick out anyway, that I reckon they're all right. So are you ready to answer some fan questions, Sam Perry?
I am. It's a real way to treat the fans as well, I suppose, as we have done every week, which is to say most of the things you submit are shit. But those that come through that are gold, thank you very, very much. And to those who have treated us, TGC, as really a short story competition, we thank you for that as well. It's given us a lot of entertainment. And if I could speak earnestly, no, thank you to everyone who has submitted questions. Some of them are shit.
Okay. Okay, here we go. We've got five good ones here, and I've got to preface this with there's one final question which is going to wrap up this year's show, it's just a bumper. Anyway, so Liam Blackwell is going to start us off, and he says, the mercury topped 42 degrees today, and the coach said that training was still on. It left me with facing a tough decision, Pez. Do I wear long sleeve playing top to be sun smart and hide my lack of pipes and risk being labelled rare? Or do I wear my training singlet and risk being alphaed for my lack of pipes? His ultimate question is here, what is worse, being labelled rare or being alphaed?
That's a wicked question, he goes. Don't they call that a wicked question in philosophy? I'm not quite sure if... there is a right answer to this. I'm really hesitant to say which is worse, being outfit or being called rare. Okay, put it this way. It's possible to succeed in cricket by being rare. You have to be very, very good, and you have to overcompensate with results. Like, it's okay to be the rare bloke if you do well. I'm not sure you've got much of a career in cricket if you regularly alphaed, though. There's no one playing for Australia who is regularly alphaed, right? You may have had the odd experience here and there, but if you're someone who is open to being alphaed, then all the time, then, you know, you're not going to be hanging around the game very long. You know, I'm going to hide under the table now that I've said that.
I like the notion that you can always preface something with, oh, you know, good bloke, but, you know, so I'm trying to think of an example, like, oh, he cheats on his wife 8 days a week, good bloke, but, you know, and the same way that you can say, you know, fucking, he's a rare unit, tell you what, smashes him, but, you know, so you can, and always finish it with but, you know, it's never though, it's always but, because it doesn't make any grammatical or English sense in any capacity, shape or form. So I agree with you. Because you can't just be like, oh, he's fucking, this bloke's weak. That's out for him.
Yeah.
Oh, he's good at cricket, though. No one's ever saying that. So I think the Skerrick of Hope with Liam here. Was it Liam who asked the question? Yeah, Liam Blackwell asked the question. Yeah, so I think being labelled rare is better.
Yeah, like there's probably 20 years of grade cricket social and political, you know, grizzled experience between us, he goes. And through that, I've learned, I don't know about you, but I've learned not to wear a training singlet unless you're sure you can pull it off. you know, I've learned that through failures.
Yeah.
You know, some might say learnings. You know, failure is just a faster road to learning. No, not really. They're just failures. It's just failure, and I wish it hadn't happened, but I'm passing that on. Don't wear it unless you got pipes, seriously.
Okay, there you go, Liam. Don't wear it unless you got pipes. Always be labelled rare as opposed to being Alfred. Tom Hartney uses the hashtag AskTGC and said, given the rise of men taking greater care of their appearance outside of regular rig work, should we expect to see a rise in salad-based selections rather than simply rig and social capital-based?
Definitely. It's a good observation, Tom. I mean, look at Tim Payne. We've all been scratching our heads, haven't we, about how Tim Payne was selected. It made no sense. He'd done nothing in Shield cricket. He'd done nothing otherwise. His finger didn't work for 9 years. We hadn't seen him. But then you looked around the Australian side. You looked at Nathan Lyon, for example, and what was going on with his salad. You looked at the general state of the attractiveness of the Australian cricket team. Consider that Mitch Marsh was brought back into the team, a guy who's literally nicknamed Bison, who has every alpha characteristic possible. And he's wonderful looking. Look at the rise of Marcus Stoinis. You know, there are things, there are patterns at play here, and I think Payne is part of that. There's, you know, Australia, you know, Donald Trump is making America great again, and Australia's making salads great again.
Really conclusive and thorough answer. I see some salad situations going on across the country, Sam. And, you know, here I am as a 31-year-old man saying that sentence. I'm just looking at Nick Madison's, you know, choice of salad, you know, that he chose to reveal in the Big Bash. I'm not sure if you've seen it. I'm not sure if it's crossed the Pacific Ocean. It's just, I mean, he's always actually a bit of a rare unit. I mean, he's, you know, fucking smashes it, but
such a reflex. This,
I think anyone's got the internet should just Google image, like his most recent salad. And I'm not sure if he's being selected ever again on the basis of this salad choice, you know, even though he smashes it, but so. Are there going to be salad-based selections? I think it's just a bold move by Nick Madison saying, come and get me. I know this isn't Tom's question necessarily, but he did raise the point about salads. And I think salads are playing a bigger and bigger, you know, part of the game. Alan Border, you know, that era of just short back and sides, private school, you know, military square buzz cuts, you know, wouldn't have stood for this. Wouldn't have stood for this. But this is a new age, new era. You know, we've had captains, i.e. Michael Clarke, with visible sleeve tattoos. You know, driving fast cars, model girlfriends, etc. You know, this is the new age. So salads are the way forward, perhaps, instead of the rig.
You said it best.
Okay. Trent Milray says, using the hashtag ICGC, after a few good years as a pace bowler playing local park cricket, a lot of wickets and encouragement from Dad has convinced me to step up to grade cricket this year. That's huge. Dad's a bit of a local cricket legend and still wants to play to this day, racking up about 600 runs in park cricket last year. He has spent a lot of time with me in the nets over the years, and I know he is proud of me. But here's the kicker. My dramatic improvement in bowling over the past year or so has been due to a change in action involving a seriously bent elbow. Dad has never mentioned it, but I've been pulled up a few times during matches now, and the blokes at training have talked to me about it too. It's become a contentious issue within the grade community, and the sledging is relentless. My question to TGC, do I continue to make my dad proud by ignoring the sledging from opposition and some teammates, and continue taking wickets as a chucker? Or do I let dad, do I let dad down by reverting back to my relatively unsuccessful yet legal action and resign myself to being the pretty average third grade park cricketer that I actually am? Cheers. Sam, should Trent keep chucking him?
Well, the first thing I want to point out is that we live in the Trump era. And
every answer.
In the Trump era, a few rules kind of abide. One is that do what it takes to get success. I mean, this is the leader of the free world. This person is the best person we can spit out to have the most power to lead to lead Western society at least. And his values are to do what it takes, cut yourself a deal, make sure that you get whatever you need to do over the line. And so in the Trump era, I would say to Trent, by all means, keep chucking, because the end goal with everything in cricket, let's face it, he goes, the end goal with cricket is to get dad's love. Why else are we playing? You could say, I mean, we just talked to Mitch Marsh, who essentially answered through the prism of his dad with everything that we asked him. Was dad here? Was he watching? What about the time when dad left when I was batting with my brother Sean? Cricket is about dad pride. And if it takes a bit of chucking to get that, then by all means keep doing it. Do not stop. Because dad's love's too important.
Mate, that's just so spot on. I don't care if Trent's pitching it. I don't care if he's standing at the crease, no run-up, and he's throwing him down. He's bowling off-cutters, he's bowling leg-cutters, you know, he's split-finger pitches. I don't care. Like, he's said that his dad's proud of him.
Hey, congratulations. Fuck, that's better than any first-grade cap. I'll tell you that for free.
If Trent could see our DMs and just asking how many, like, you look at the questions that we get, how many times people are just like, how do I get my dad to love me? How do I get my dad to stop offering me? Trent's got this made. I'm not really sure why he's still playing. Like, he's got it. I guess he has to play forever, given that his dad's a local cricket legend and he's still playing himself. So, like, he has to keep playing until, someone's knees stop working, basically. But, like, I mean, Trent, never go back to, you know, some sort of legal action.
Okay, he goes
as you want.
Sorry to interrupt you. He goes, like, can I just submit off the top of my head and ask TGC to you on the back of this?
Yes.
Okay. Hashtag ask TGC. G'day, guys. Love you. Love your show.
Is this going to be 8,000 words?
I've got a short story entry. No. Okay, he goes, hypothetical. Would you prefer to play 5 tests for Australia, but your dad never comes nor knows about it, though you still have a relationship? Or play like 100 first grade matches and your dad comes to everyone and tells you that he really appreciates the hard work you put in and the skill that you put into the game?
Well, this is just the ultimate ultimatum.
It's an easy answer. It's 100 first grade games, because what's the point?
Isn't it? I'm just trying to justify it to the listeners, but it's an easy answer. It's the 100 first grade games.
Yeah.
Imagine your dad saying he's proud of you. Okay, next question. Andrew Cameron says, g'day, guys. I'm an Australian living in Shanghai. I really enjoy this question. It came in late, but I really enjoyed it. I'm an Australian living in Shanghai. Sliding this into Facebook Messenger as the firewall makes it too annoying for Twitter or Instagram. I'm a big fan of the page and the podcast, and even scored TNO sympathy for Christmas on my recent end-of-year trip back to Sydney. Cool. Now that I'm back in sub-zero Shanghai, I've been going to the coffee shop across the road from my apartment each day before work, even though it costs the equivalent of $5 for a very average coffee. I've been going there a while now, so the girl behind the counter knows I can speak some Chinese, and often has a chat with me if she's not busy. This morning, while handing over my coffee, she remarked in a complimentary tone about how thick my hands were. This is not something I've ever been told. However, if I've learned anything from TGC, it's that big hands, along with big pipes, good rig, and good salad, pipes and rig average for me with no salad to speak of, are the sort of qualities every girl is looking for. My question, therefore, is, does her complimenting the size of my hands mean she has a crush on me? And if so, how much of a discount should I aim for on my Lex Latte? Cheers, Camo. Big hands.
I don't know, he goes, my hands are fairly slender and thin, so I can't empathise with this a lot. No salad, slim hands. Go figure, hey. But thanks God and Dad. But also, he goes, have your hands look all right? Any thoughts?
Well, Camo, Andrew Cameron from Shanghai has said that he's got no salad to speak of. So you've got similarities there.
Well, at least he's got something.
But it's interesting that he's got thick hands. I haven't heard of thick hands before. I've heard of big hands. The importance of big hands can't be underestimated. You can alpha any handshake. You're going to dominate every businessman you've ever been to, every crushing victory against an opposition where they give you like the wet fish handshake with no eye contact. You can just fucking slide right into those fingers, you know, right into the midst of their palms and alpha them through a handshake. You know, big hands just equals huge dick is what this comes down to, essentially. Fuck, look how big his hands are. I mean, that's what people think, isn't it, really? I mean, you can say that you can, you know, he's got big buckets on this bloke. He never drops them, but that's what we're all getting to. So Camo's got that going for him. But thick hands, Sam.
I think thick is good. I think thick's really good. I think thick's as good as big. Like, I don't even think length is really the issue here. Like, long and slender is not as good as sort of short and thick when it comes to hands. It's a masculine thing. It's a sense of your, like, of your general thickness, you know, body. Like, oh, we're really ending on a high here, aren't we?
Did you this is it, this is how it ends. Did you ever know a guy who batted with a long handle?
Yeah, like I can't think of one off the top of my head, but I'm familiar with the concept of people doing that. Yeah, the long handle.
Yeah, like, I mean, how tall do you have to be to actually use a long handle? Like, I mean, because I'm 6'1", and it never occurred to me that I ever needed that sort of thing. Like, you need to be, like, 6'6". Like, what's the... I mean, it's just a really odd thing to have, like, you to be so tall that you need a bigger handle to hit the ball. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it might just be a case of wanting to look like you've got big hands. The thing is, if you use a long handle and you have normal-sized hands, your hands will look particularly small. Can we move on?
All right, so let's answer Andrew's question, though. Like, I mean, does this mean that the girl has a crush on him?
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. If a girl had a... I mean, I'm married, by the way, and I love my wife dearly. Hello, Tori, in the other room. protective privacy. But if I was in a coffee shop and a girl said to me, "You have really thick hands," I'd be like...
Yeah.
Fantastic.
My place, I mean, or yours.
It's funny that he's immediately gone to sort of a financial gain from that, though. I'm not sure. I think it's like we're operating in the realm of physicality. Like, we're physically complimenting each other. We're not looking at, you know, clearly this is a great cricketer who's gone to Shanghai for financial purposes. I mean, I don't, yeah. Andrew, I don't think she's probably able to give you a discounted coffee, but she's really blown up your ego. So just think of it in that way.
I don't think she has the authority to give you, you know, all of a sudden the equivalent of $2.50 coffees, you know, lattes. I don't think she has that authority. I don't think she has the, you know, the leave pass to do that. Anyway, all right. Oh, yes, Andrew. Yes, she's hitting on you. She wants your big, thick hands. I hope you're having a nice time in Shanghai. I don't know how to finish that. All right. Yeah. This is the last question of
a big one.
TGC season. And it's a big one.
It's a short story.
It's a short story. It's one of the better ones I've heard. So bear with me, listener, and settle in for the ride. Andrew Curtis has written in on the Twitter machine, slid into the DMs, and he said, "Dear Grade Cricketer..."
You can tell it's long, he goes, when the start is like a formal letter. Not hashtag RTGC, it's "Dear Grade Cricketer, comma, and then new paragraph." Like, beautifully spaced.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a lot of time's been spent on this, so it's worthy. All right, here we go. Dear Grade Cricketer. Thank you for getting me through a long, cold, dark winter in England. The sooner I can find a justifiable reason to escape the sunnier climates in Australia, the better, particularly if it brings me closer to the grade cricket scene you hold in such high esteem and talk of so endearingly. I'm actually getting in touch because I want you to decide the fate of my cricketing career. I'm a washed-up, mediocre cricketer, having had a dalliance with minor counties cricket in the UK and a one-off debut in first grade when the coach took pity on me for the last game of the season. I now work in market research in the alcohol industry, essentially spending my Monday to Friday analysing how much I'm going to spend on my weekend circuit. Last summer, I evaded playing cricket under the guise that on moving to London, I would need time to settle in, establish my social circle, and choose the best club. However, a year has passed and that is no longer a legitimate excuse. I'm an opening bat who used to bowl occasional left-arm spin. I use the term used to because I've been left irreversibly scarred with a cricketing equivalent of PTSD by my last experience. We had posted a highly respectable 230 in an early season encounter and thought we were at least 30 above par. The opposition overseas, name drop Glenn Phillips, Kiwi T20 wicketkeeper, was taking the game away from us and the skipper was looking around for someone to stand up and be counted. So I did. And you can count the number of balls lost too. First ball, a little nervous, bowling slow left arm, I fired down the leg side. The keeper misses it and it goes for five wides. The next four balls, yes four, are all lost. Glenn has taken a liking to my bowling and dispatched all four of them over the 30-foot high fence designed to keep balls out of the £1 million mansions that back onto the ground. Alas, at this point, we'd actually run out of spare balls, so having gone for 29 off the first four legal deliveries, I think Glenn took pity on me and patted the next two back. We lost the match. Needless to say, though, I will not be bowling ever again. So my question is this, do I play cricket again? On the one hand, it allows me to socialise with people who will also enjoy discussing the frailties of England's middle order over a pint at 2 a.m. On the other hand, many more lonely weekends of deep square leg to cover beckon whilst I ask myself, is the only reason I'm still playing this because it forces me to delay opening my first beer until after the match is finished? Is the £15 match fee going to be a constant reminder that, yes, I'm having to pay for that horrendous 20 ball five I just ground out? Do I really want some Surrey Academy nuffy flinging down rockets on my head when I've had six pints the night before because the forecast said 70% chance of rain? Do I really want to celebrate winning with my new teammates when I dropped a catch, got my first start of the season before being run out for 20, and really it feels like another small piece of me has died? Do I really think that one 100 is worth it when I know that I'll get to the office on Monday and be struck by the total and utter futility of it all, and that the number of 100 holds absolutely zero significance to anyone not versed in the logic of this great game? Well, probably not, but great game, it is so. Perhaps I will. I should give it one last go? To conclude, I think it's a pretty damning condemnation of my total loss of love for the game that having this read out would ultimately far exceed any turge of early season 30s I could grind out for a new club. Admittedly, on the circuit, it was worth 90 because the pitch was green seeming, and it's 5 degrees, but nobody cares, and that's not why it says on my cricket. Hashtag AskTGC. All right, Pez. Andrew Curtis, we're going to decide his cricketing future. He's essentially asking, should I play again? I really enjoy that story, and I probably didn't do it justice reading because it's hard to read that much out loud in small font on a computer. But just giving unnecessary excuses. But
because it's hard.
Yeah, because I can. So should he play again? Keep in mind, his last game he got bombed by a Kiwi T20 wicketkeeper, Glenn Phillips. He's a guy who's obviously done well. He's played some minor counties. That is, for anybody who doesn't know the English system, that's a very respectable and good level of cricket. So to that end, Pez, he's laid it all out before us. I mean, should he play?
Well, it's just a fantastic submission. Here goes a great choice from you. Really well written, and I really listened to this carefully because I can identify with it quite a lot. Someone who is ordinarily a batsman who used to bowl spin, who is ultimately scarred by the experience. You've just been hit too many times. I feel like I'm actually in a similar position in my cricket journey. I was done with the game a couple of years ago after grade cricket, but I enjoyed a few games. I'm sorry to bring this to myself, but I enjoyed a few games in England this year. And really, the question that's in my head, and I feel this reading listening to what Andrew said here, or what Andrew writes here, is that he needs to reconcile his relationship to the game. I'm a bit concerned that he, when he thinks about what the game means to him, he goes through all the things that are bad about it, and he wonders if he should give it one last go. That infers that giving it a last go might mean that he'll have a reversal in those fortunes. Andrew, you won't have a reversal in those fortunes. That will happen. That happens every year. It does not change. Any change is minor. It operates on a spectrum that just tilts here and there a little bit, but ultimately cricket is deep square leg to cover for the majority. It's 5/20 for the majority. Even the best players say that. So you need to ask yourself if that's what you want. Like, if you can find some deeper meaning to it, some aspect of it in your life where it gives you a fulfillment or a satisfaction that goes beyond what you see on the scorecard. And I think that goes to all of us. It's an appropriate one to finish with. You know, what is your relationship to the game? What is it about? Ultimately, from my understanding, my sociological views of cricket, the people who enjoy cricket the most are the ones who enjoy everything around it. They enjoy the lying, they enjoy the beers, they enjoy the masquerading and the macho horseplay. That's really what it's about. Anything that happens on the pitch doesn't really matter because it's going to be shit. It's always shit, you know? And that's hard in this Trump era because we always want to look good. Social media means we want to curate a reputation that always looks good. We need productivity. Cricket does not offer productivity. Your output will be shit most of the time. If you can abide that and understand that there's other reasons to play the game, then play. But if you need to be good, don't play because you won't be good.
That is just the most succinct, perfect answer that has just surmised our entire account. Sam Perry, it's been an absolute wonderful joy, pleasure. The conviviality of it all has been profound. I've had a wonderful time speaking with you and, of course, Dave, over the course of the summer. We are going to take a little bit of a break over the next few weeks, perhaps coming back for the South Africa tour. We certainly hope so. So bear with us while we take that break. Pez, I'm sure you've enjoyed the summer as well.
Oh, it's been amazing. You know, thanks to you and to Dave, especially for and to the listeners first, actually, especially if you've made it this far in what has easily been the longest episode. They've gotten longer as the time's gone on, probably a reflection of how much we're enjoying it. So thank you to the listeners for bearing with us. Thanks to you, Higos and Dave, for handling the fact that I've moved to London and this is a bit of a technical balancing act. It takes a few technical acrobatics to get this up, but I think we've done well. We've had more listeners this year than we had last year. I think our caliber of guests has been better as well. Thank you to all the guests who've joined and helped. Thank you to all those guests who then subsequently sent us text messages when we asked for them anonymously, giving insight into the next guest and anything that was wrong with them. Some of them couldn't be read out, but it's been enjoyable all the same. Thank you to Fox Sports as well for supporting us and you know, running our articles every week and helping us promote the book. And thank you to everyone who did buy our book this year as well. You can still buy it if you want. You can still buy books after Christmas, but whether you did or didn't, thank you for listening to us talk about it anyway and putting up with our fairly relentless promotion of it. I hope it wasn't too overbearing.
Wonderfully said, Pez. To that end, who knows what's next for the great cricketer? Hopefully some TV work, maybe some radio. Yeah. I don't know. The social media thing will still be a thing. It'll still exist. We'll still keep pushing forward with that. Thanks as ever for tuning in. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you know the score. You know where to find us. If you want us to host your event, your cricket season event, Sam's in the UK, hit him up. Dave and I are in Sydney. Hit us up. You know, there's an email that you can find us or get us on social media and contact us that way. Hurry up, though, because spots are filling up fast and those events are coming around very quickly. Sam Perry, thank you so much for joining me every week. Thanks for doing the editing and the production work every single week. It's been fantastic. Thanks again to all of our guests. We'll see you around, hopefully, in a few weeks' time.